Hello, everyone. Welcome again to the Stick to Wrestling podcast. My name is John McAdam. I am here with Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you doing right now?
Good, John. Watching the Patriots game in mute.
Same here. Now, we have a special show. Recently, Dave Meltzer and his Wrestling Observer newsletter came out with their list of Hall of Fame candidates. Now, a lot of podcasts are doing a podcast about that. So Sean and I, we have no choice but to not just do a podcast about that, but to do the best podcast about that. And to ensure that that happens, we have brought on someone who I don't think you've ever been on a wrestling podcast before, but he's really knowledgeable about wrestling. He's a smart guy, and he shares my passion for Hall of Fames. Ladies and gentlemen, introducing Thomas Bain from Pittsburgh. Thomas, how are you?
Oh, well, you've really screwed the pooch giving me this big of a hype here. So I hope I don't pull the Bobby Brady and see the red light and just freeze up the entire time. But great to be here, guys. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Hey, I didn't even bring up your good work as a union rep. Now, Thomas was good enough. He wanted to be on the show bad enough where he went out and he's actually parked somewhere right now. They're in the middle of a really bad rainstorm where he is in Morgantown, West Virginia. So if his audio is a little bit down, that's the reason, and we apologize, but we're going to get through this and we're going to have a whole lot of fun. Guys, I am very into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. What are your thoughts on the whole thing? First of all, Thomas.
Well, I love the Hall of Fame. I think it's a great gauge of the history of not only American wrestling in the present, but the history of American wrestling, you know, from the beginning, and also Mexico, Japan, Europe, everywhere else. I guess the only knock I would have on the Observer Hall of Fame is the fact that Meltzer put so many guys in that first year that you really don't know who that inaugural class would have been.
That's true, and I guess like all Hall of Fames, a little bit of it is political. Like I think Stu Hart was kind of a political pick.
Yeah, and when you look at it, even when you look at the voting, there's obviously when folks pass away, Ivan Koloff being a great example, the death knell gives you a spike in that, and I think that's why someone like, and we'll get to him in a little bit later, Paul Jones is on the ballot this year for the first time ever. So,
yeah, I believe Captain Lou Albano absolutely belongs in the Observer Hall of Fame, but I just also don't believe it was a coincidence that he got in after he passed.
That's the case in any sport.
Yeah, Curry Puckett.
I mean, that's just a human emotion.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about, none of the three of us have a vote, but what if we did have a vote? Who would we vote for? Let's start with our guest, Thomas Bain. Thomas, who's your number one guy on your ballot?
Number one guy on my ballot actually is Archie the Mongolian Stomper Goldie, and while he doesn't have that famed NWA, WWF, you know, major run, he was a major success everywhere. I mean, everyone knows about Stampede. Everyone knows about Memphis. Even as far recent as 1980, winning the Georgia title off Jack Briscoe. But he also had pretty good runs in Puerto Rico, had a great run in Kansas City, had a good run in San Francisco. This guy
was
drunk where he went.
Yeah, I was going to say Knoxville and Thomas had mentioned Georgia. Interesting pick. Yeah. Is he on the ballot? He must.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's go to you, Sean. Who's your number one guy on your ballot?
Okay. So are we going for the historical performance right now or the whole thing?
Whoever's number one, man. The number one guy out there that you think belongs in the Observer Hall of Fame.
Then I will go with one of the non-wrestlers. I'll say Bill Apter.
Well, you took my number one away from me, bro.
I don't see what the argument against it is. I mean, he basically invented a source of media. I mean, I know other people did it before. But the whole format, the way, you know, all those magazines were when we grew up, were done. That was Bill Apter's thing. You cannot tell the history of wrestling without Bill.
But I would say this, though, Sean. Shouldn't Stanley Weston get a portion of the credit that Bill Apter gets, though? Was Apter more the face, or was he more the main guy?
I was going to say, I was actually going to bring up Stanley Weston right before you did. To me, Bill Apter, it was Stanley Weston's car. He owned the Enterprise. But Bill Apter was the guy behind the wheel. He made the whole thing happen. Someone once wrote, oh yeah, all Bill Apter did was write stupid columns in between the pictures. The pictures were all that mattered. Those are Apter's pictures. He's the one that took them. And think about how much wrestling history would be gone without the pictures Bill Apter took. So I would not only be in favor of Apter, I would go for him as a photographer alone. But I mean, to me, you could have justified putting him in the class of 96. That's how high I am on Bill Apter.
Bill created a wrestling mythology. What Bill did for wrestling is the same thing that Steve and Ed Sable did for the NFL.
Good one.
But I think the slope gets a little slippery just kind of putting – if you put Apter in 96, that means that 22 years later, you could make an argument that someone like George Napolitano should be on the ballot then. If Apter's that high up on the hierarchy, I mean, how big of a difference is there between Apter and Napolitano in terms of photography?
Oh, I think there's a big difference, but I mean, I get what you're saying, Bill Apter. One reason I think he's not in is that there's really no one to compare him to outside of a Napolitano, unless there's someone else I'm forgetting.
As far as stature in that business, the only one who's even close is Dave.
And it's a completely different business.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and you know what? Like, I've met George before. I like George. He's a great guy. I just don't see him in Apter's league. Well, I guess that leaves me with to discuss my number two. Now, if I had a ballot, I would only have four names four names that I would vote for as inductees to the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. All three of my remaining candidates are not on the ballot. And my number two guy, because Sean has my number one guy, is Greg Valentine. Now, I can defend this. I can more than defend this. I really believe he belongs in the Hall of Fame. Valentine was the top heel in the wrestling business from, let's say, January 1st, 1976 through, I would say, January 1st, 1986. That's 10 years. Was he the number one guy the whole time? No. But if you had to vote for that 10-year period, it's Greg Valentine. Held the U.S. title in Crockett twice, which is a really big deal. Held the NWA tag team titles multiple times. Had two very memorable runs against Bob Backlund. Had a big run against Hulk Hogan. Won the Intercontinental title back when that was a really big deal. Held the tag team titles with Beefcake back when that was a big deal. I think he belongs not only just on the ballot, I believe he belongs in.
I think there's a group of...
Go ahead, Thomas.
Okay. I'll say, why don't we start with Thomas?
I think Greg Valentine is on that fine line of guys who aren't on the ballot, who are on the cusp of the Hall of Fame. They're either the first guy in or the first guy out, along with like guys like Ken Patera, guys like Don Morocco, who inexplicably have not been on the ballot. And another guy, that a tag team that I'll put on there, do you realize that for some reason, maybe this is my youth, coming into play here, but Rick and Scott Steiner never got above 10% of the ballot either, which blew my mind. But I think they're all in that cusp of either the first guys in or the last guys in or the first guys out.
Greg has two problems. The first is the fact that, I know he was a babyface for a little bit in 1984. That was out of desperation. That's because there was no one else there. That was not by choice. There was just nobody else. You want Greg as a heel. You want him as a heel. That's one. The second thing is bad timing. There was always someone just a little bit better. It's like the Bengals in the 70s. They're a really good team, but unfortunately, Pittsburgh's right there.
Well, like Valentine's he's a lot like a Burt Blyleven, who had a great 15-year peak, but the last 5 years really muddled things up for him. And I think
good
if
analogy.
You look at Greg Valentine, if you look at Greg Valentine, like 88 to 92, does that putridness outweigh 77-83. I think the good outweighs the bad, but I think people can be justified saying his end was so terrible. It was so lackluster. He looked like the definition of, he needed a phone cord painted on his boots. That's how bad he phoned it in from 88 on.
I agree with you. I was one of those people who, like 89, 90, was saying that Greg Valentine was so overrated. He really was one of the worst wrestlers in the business. We're talking Ultimate Warrior level bad. He actually had a decent series against Ronnie Garvin, but yeah, he was really bad towards the end. But in my opinion, that it shouldn't work against him. And Bill James had an expression to Hall of Famers: you have your highlights and you have your scenery. And the scenery is that, you know, those 5 or 6 years where you're just adding up those career stats when you're getting to 3,000 hits, even though you're not that good anymore. To me, that's what that was for Greg Valentine.
Greg Valentine's upside was so good. Every place from, what, I'd say 70, 76, 77 up through to 85, he was main eventing wherever he was.
Yeah.
He was on the top of the card wherever he was. He was in the, you know, short list as, you know, one of the contenders for the WWF Championship. He just basically won it. The belt guy held up for, you know. I mean, and what was that deal? Were they fishing a little bit, or was that just an angle?
You know what? We're pressed for time on the Hall of Fame show, but I'll tell you what, I'll talk about that next week, because one of the guys who was in the WWF told me what was going on. Whether or not it's true, I don't know, but he gave me the lowdown on that. But
fair enough. Either way, that's fine. But nonetheless, he was in consideration for the WWF Championship, serious consideration. You know, he was, you know, in the discussion for the, you know, he would have been a fine NWA touring champion. I mean, as long as you, it's better to babyface, but as long as you can heal, you're fine. You know, as a champion at that point. So, I would say he's a little bit above Morocco. Morocco just took too many days off. I mean, in his prime.
Okay.
I remember those old garden crowd, those old garden shows where, oh man, you just knew if Dawn just wasn't interested. When he was on, he was on. He was as good as there was, but damn, you could tell when he wasn't interested.
Yeah. All right. Well, Thomas, who's next on your ballot? Who's your number two?
This might be a controversial pick, but I'll defend it anyway. It's Jim Crockett Sr. When you look at the NWA hierarchy from 1948 to about, let's just call it a flat line, 1968, arguably the three most influential people in the NWA and probably the most top five influential people in wrestling were Lou Fez, Sam Mushnick, and Jim Crockett Sr. Now, I don't know. Obviously, Mushnick and Fez have a much more greater impact on the world of wrestling. But from what he started and what he created and what his kid invariably screwed up, Jim Crockett Sr. is the forebear to Mid-Atlantic wrestling.
I don't think that's a controversial pick at all.
No, I mean, I probably put in Junior first because of the scope of his vision. But he was there for a long time and a greatly respected guy.
The problem with promoters is sometimes there are so many guys who had so many good runs that it's hard to distinct one from the other. Like, you know, I think if you want to put in Jim Crockett Sr., that doesn't automatically put Jerry Jarrett in. It doesn't automatically put Don Owen in, but it certainly strengthens their case. And to me, you can't put every promoter in the Hall of Fame. Like, even if they have a good case, a lot of them have good cases.
And I don't even think personally that Don Owen is a Hall of Famer in my eyes. I mean, just because Portland was sustainable, were they sustainable because he was a good promoter? Or because nobody was going out there and no one was trying to raid that territory because it was so centered on one area, which is Portland.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, like I said, I mean, my point is, I mean, I think promoters are tough, but I mean, Jim Crockett Sr. definitely has an excellent case. And you know what? It sounds like you know more about him than I do, so I defer to you.
Well, I mean, he was the right-hand man, the vice president of the NWA for pretty much until he got sick in the late 60s, early 70s, and he kind of passed it off, which is kind of why Fritz ended up getting the power that he got was when Crockett Sr. died.
Good point. All right, Sean, who is next on your ballot?
Well, I had a wrestler here, but since we brought up a promoter, I'll bring up another one in Memphis, Jerry Jarrett. He was there for a long time. He basically invented a style that has been, you know, for good or bad, has been copied many times. Not always as successfully, but it's been copied. He produced a lot of stars out of that region. And, you know, just the size, you know, just as strong as that after they got invaded by the WWF, by WCW, nobody could touch them in Memphis for a long time. It was just that strong of a product. And again, it was just how many times it was impersonated, how many times they stole from it. ECW stole from it. WWF stole from it.
That's true. Japan stole from it.
I like Jarrett. I like Jarrett as a pick, and I'll tell you why. They had that same loop running from the LBJ administration until, you know, Bush 1 administration. And there was never a prolonged burnout by the fans there, whether it was Louisville, Evansville, Memphis, you know, Johnson City, wherever the case may be. The crowds came out consistently for 20 years there under Jerry Jarrett. And the fact that he never had that depression where the house, the gates were low. I mean, when you really think about it, the hottest angle that Memphis is known for outside of the Uber fan is Lawler, Andy Kaufman, and their numbers didn't draw very well compared to the average Jerry Jarrett show.
Exactly.
Right. What was the other great, what was the other famous angle that most fans outside of Memphis will say?
I would
Idle
say
Rich? Probably the Funk and Lawler one. Funk and Lawler from the empty arena.
And that didn't draw.
That didn't draw either. So Jarrett knew that crowd. That was a textbook way of how to run a territory. He understood that audience as well as he possibly could have. I mean, that's why the booking, and I love the whole, we've talked about this last couple of weeks, I love the six on, six off. I think that was inspired.
He made money with the Moondogs in the 1990s. just put it out there.
The Moondogs with Richard Lee.
He made a main event heel out of Paul Ellering.
Oh, Paul Ellering was brutal, man.
Yep, he was terrible.
All right. My next pick, and I'm going to give you a little background on this. I want to say in early 2003, there was a big, I was going to say a dust up, an argument. It was a hearty debate that was sometimes went into an argument over whether or not the Andersons should be in the Hall of Fame. Now, when I say like a great big debate, this thing went about, I want to say 40 or 50 pages. There were 40 responses per page. So that means there's like 2,000 posts about this, whether or not the Andersons should be in. Now, at the time, I was saying that, you know, yep, they had great careers and it's just not enough. They're just not. They fall just short. That was my opinion at the time, over 15 years ago. My opinion has changed because the information bank has changed. Since then, the Sharp Brothers, the Assassins, the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express, and the Freebirds have all been inducted to the Observer Hall of Fame, and the Andersons could more than hang with any of those five teams.
Absolutely. They were top of the card main event team for what, 14 years in two separate territories. And the argument, yeah, well, they didn't do it in other territories. They didn't have to. The only reason you went to other territories is because you had to freshen the act up. They were able to keep their same thing going for 14 years.
This gets back to politics. And I'll tell you why. When you take the whole, When you take the whole tag team issue out of it and you look at just his career alone, Ole Anderson's a Hall of Famer, by himself, counting the stuff with Gene and counting his entire career in of itself, he's a Hall of Famer. Now, you can make a sound argument that Ole and Gene are, but they neither Ole and Gene or Ole himself could get enough votes. Ole didn't even crack 20% as a single or as a solo, you know, inductee. And a lot of people really think, you know, Ole's a sourpuss. Ole, you know, cut out Jim Barnett, which ultimately probably killed Georgia eventually. Ole was a shitty booker in WCW, and then that stink follows him around now. But Ole and Gene, ask me tomorrow. Today, I say no. Ole's a single yes.
See, I see the reverse. I would say Greg Valentine's above Ole as a single. He was a good single. But as a tag team, they were top of the card against some of the best. I mean, they made evented for years. Can you imagine that long? 14 years back then. Who did that? Jerry Lawler did it. I mean, the Assassins were in Georgia for what, 8? But I mean, who was there that long?
And as a top act.
Yeah, absolutely. Top of the card, because the tag team was always, that was the main belt in Mid-Atlantic back then, was the tag team championship.
And you see, here's the thing, you know, I'm trying to make it apples to apples, which is not always easy when you talk about Hall of Famers, but you look at the tag teams that are in there now, and the Andersons, you know, they fit right in, and they're not like, oh, well, they're a little bit better or worse than whoever the worst tag team is. They can fly with any of those guys. Ole as a single, it gets a little more complicated, and I just don't see him, you know, as a middle of the pack Hall of Famer. I mean, when you look at the guys we're comparing him to, I don't know. Thomas, who is next on your list?
The next person on my list, and really, there's no hierarchy here at this point in time. Just, you know, names that I felt were, you know, deserve to be recognized, is John Tolos. Now, Tolos had a little bit of a run in Texas near the end of his career, but he's mainly known for the feud with Freddie Blassie. And that feud, I will maintain, aside from the Von Erichs Freebirds, was probably the greatest program west of the Mississippi before the Monday Night Wars. I'll put it that way. That drew money hand over fist. It made Tolos a star. Tolos was viewed as a tag team guy with his brother for a long time in the WWF and other places. That made him a star, and that bought him 25 years of equity all across the country just with that feud alone with Blassie.
Interesting pick. He was a huge star in Los Angeles. He also had this feud with Victor Rivera, and you're right, with his brother Chris, you know, they were a top tag team.
Again, that was a time. That was a time in Capital when the tag teams were a big deal, because you had Rocca and Perez, you had the Grahams, you had Lewin and Curtis. So that was the big deal at that time, and you had the Hamiltons, the Assassin and his brother. So that was an era for. So if you were a main event tag team in Madison Square Garden, which they were, that was a significant deal. See, I don't know are we even having this discussion if you take that Blassie feud out? And how much of that feud was Blassie?
I think it's give and take. Obviously, if Tolos Blassie doesn't happen, he's not a Hall of Famer. I'm not gonna make that argument. But I think that feud was so epic, and in my eyes, might have been the greatest feud of the 70s. And certainly, you know, west of, you know, Capital, WWF and Mid-Atlantic and Georgia was the best feud until Von Erich Freebirds. I just think it was a component of it.
Outside, the only other feud I can think of I'm almost playing devil's advocate because I love that feud. It was the details. I love any feud like that, because that was the other feud I loved from that time. It was a little after that, but was Slaughter and Canoodle against Youngblood, and, you know, for the same reason. It was just the details that were in the feud. But yeah, he was a great performer in two biggest markets in the country.
you know, I want to touch upon something Sean said. All tag team titles are not created equal, okay? If you are part of, you know, the WWE Raw Tag Team Champions right now, it actually hinders your Hall of Fame case, because all it shows is that they don't think enough of you to make you a singles wrestler. You're relegated into this division that just doesn't mean as much anymore. But back in the day, those tag team titles were huge, and not only the era you were talking about in the Northeast, Sean, but, like, you know, in the Carolinas, that was a tag team territory, and you would see the tag titles, you know, held by main eventers and wrestled in the main event.
Tag team titles was the main event in Mid-Atlantic for years and years and years through pretty much the 70s.
I mean, when Ric Flair is part of your tag team champions, Ricky Steamboat, et cetera, Greg Valentine, you know, your
Paul
top
Jones.
Stars are getting the Paul Jones, exactly. You're getting your top guys in the tag teams.
Well, look at tag teams now compared to then. When a tag team breaks up now, it's a mid-card, lower mid-card feud just designed to put 8 minutes of TV, you know, per week on there. Nothing more, nothing less. One guy elevates, one guy goes to the bottom of the card. When Paul Jones and Ricky Steamboat broke up, that was main event material immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look, I mean, look at even the Crockett manifesto, you know, on down the line with Kurnudel and Koloff, Windham and Luger. They kept that going, and they didn't relegate those guys once they broke up to being on the second match on the card. Those were ready-made main event matches.
It also helped that Jones and Steamboat were both main eventers.
Well, right. I mean, that was the thing. The WWF, as time went on, you know, their tag teams, I mean, I've used this analogy a lot. There was always a Batman and a Robin. Dino Bravo was a big star. Dominic DiNucci was washed up. Ivan Putski was a big star. Tito Santana was not a star yet, etc. You know, you had one guy who was, yeah, maybe kind of a main eventer, and one guy who was a mid-carder. And please don't get me started on stuff like the Yukon Lumberjacks. So, Sean, who is next on your list?
Okay, I guess I'll have a... Let's see. I'd say Junkyard Dog. I know the matches were bad. I know you had to have a tag team partner with him. He was revolutionary. I mean, he completely made that territory. He was completely new. He changed the business. You can't tell the history of wrestling without talking about the Junkyard Dog.
It's true. And you're right. He made that territory, which I was lucky enough to get to see in like early 1980. And they don't have any footage of it as far as I know. But the early Junkyard Dog just kicked some serious ass. And not only was he, you know, he got out of shape, really out of shape as time went on. But the 1980 version of Junkyard Dog, which, by the way, he was on TBS. So we have some footage from that.
Yeah.
He was not a bad worker. And he was in fantastic shape, and you believed in this guy.
I guess my question is, for Junkyard Dog's candidacy, is his peak wasn't very long. As a matter of fact, you could argue that his fall was longer than his climb. When he basically from 85 all the way through 90 with WCW, he just free fell from mid-85 on. So what I would say is, granted that he put Mid-South and put them on the map permanently, but again, is it this time? I think the bad might outweigh the good in this case, other than, you know, as aside from Valentine's, you know, 88 to 92 run.
The bad's probably greater than the good, but I'd put it under like the Joe Namath rule, that his contributions were so significant that you kind of have to overlook the 50,000 interceptions he threw.
JYD, I remember, like, right around, certainly by the time he was wrestling Harley Race at WrestleMania 3, we were all kind of like, oh, man, this guy's happy.
They're toast.
Yeah.
Even Harley looked great in front of him and compared to him.
But, you know, again, he's an interesting – you're right. He had such an amazing peak. And he was a huge star when he first got to the WWF. It wasn't just Mid-South. I mean, I feel like he's one of those guys, and I say this probably too much when it comes to Hall of Fame discussions. He's got a really good case, but in my eyes, he falls a little bit short.
You're wrong.
Ah, well, you were told me that I'm wrong about my next guy, my final Hall of Fame candidate. And this is someone, once again, he is not on the ballot, but I believe that he shouldn't be on the ballot because he should.
Angelo Mosca Jr.?
That's my fifth guy. He's the one who just fell short.
Okay.
Is Magnificent Morocco. Now, here's my case for him. He got off to a good start in the AWA. He was a big star in Florida. Then he came to the WWF in 1981 and exploded. He won the Intercontinental title, and in my view, he's the guy who put the Intercontinental title on the map. He's the one who made that title seem real to me. He had a huge run against Backlund. He had the one-hour draws against Bob, which I don't think had been done before or since. I take that back. He did an hour with Greg Valentine at MSG. But Morocco's the only one who went around the horn with it, and they turned it into a gimmick where, okay, the rematch is 2 hours, I think it was. Then he goes to Mid-Atlantic/Georgia, has a short but memorable run there, back to the WWF, where I thought for sure he was going to win the title, but he didn't. He won the Intercontinental title again, still a big deal, had another major series against Backlund, took a little time off, came back, managed by Mr. Fuji, had, and a lot of people don't know this, they forget about this, when WrestleMania was being built up, it was Morocco and Hogan that were doing the house shows, and they had a three-match series at Madison Square Garden. So that's three major runs at MSG. That he probably peaked around there, but once again, like Valentine, you know, I just gave you the highlights. The rest is the scenery. You know, and he got the feud against the newly turned Roddy Piper as well. I think that's enough to get in.
I love Don. I do. I mean, I don't mean to make it sound like my problem with Dawn is that the good Dawn is so good. It's just fantastic. And then you have the bad Dawn because you're getting one or the other. You're not getting like you never have like a oh, yeah, that was a good Dawn performance. No, he's either going to be brilliant or he's going to be you're just going to lay in the ring like a lump for like 30 minutes.
What comes to me as a complete shock is when you go through the observer votes. And if you don't crack 10%, you're bounced out. Now, sometimes guys like Kerry Von Erich, Ken Patera, they'll get under 10%, and then Meltzer will put them back on down the road. Don Morocco has not been on the ballot since 2005. I don't know if Meltzer just feels he's persona non grata in terms of getting in the hall, but when you look at the list of people on here, how is it that Don Morocco gets bounced off in 1 year and they put Sabu on the ballot? How is that possible?
I think the process, though, is if a voter – like I know Brian Last is personally responsible for getting Curry on the ballot. Wild Bill Curry, why can't I remember his first name? My understanding is if you go to Dave, you know, via email or whatever and make a case for a guy and say, hey, you know, I would vote for him. I think he should at least be put out there for consideration. He does it.
He's a guy with the eyebrows, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the all. Okay, that's not enough to get someone in the Hall of Fame. Is the first thing I think of is yeah, you're the eyebrow guy.
Well, he has a really interesting history. Brian dug up a lot of cool stuff on him, and he was a really big star in the late 50s and the 60s into the early 70s.
Uh-oh, I'm going to get yelled at after the show.
Wild Bull Curry is the kind of guy that a lot of voters may not recognize, and he probably missed out on getting inducted because Meltzer, who's the foremost expert on historical wrestling, didn't put him in. So it's going to be so much harder for the average fan to recognize him as opposed to like when you see like Sting get 60% of the vote or Bill Goldberg get 25% of the vote. You see Curry just languishing in there and you see Rocky Johnson on the ballot, which that's another topic for another day. But I'm not saying that he's not a Hall of Famer. I just think it'll be very, very difficult to get him in.
I agree. I am not in love with this historical wrestler list here. I mean, you know, I guess they're fine, but I mean, it's this. If I'm making my own list of guys who aren't in, who should be in, this isn't a list I have.
Okay, I'm looking at the list now.
You're naming some of them now.
I mean, let me see. Well, I mean, I was going to bring this up anyway. Let's say George Steele's family contacts you, and they hire you to lobby to put him in to the Hall of Fame. Where do you even start?
I mean, know I have integrity.
John, let me ask you a question here.
Yeah.
And this is being serious here. When you look at George Steele's Hall of Fame resume, obviously there's no in-ring ability. He didn't really influence anybody. It's not because of him that Bruiser Brody exists as a wild man character. No. Wild Bull Curry already did it. Pampero Ferpo already did it. So basically you're looking at box office ability, which I don't think he had. So let's be honest here. Who made a company more money, George the Animal Steel or Dennis Rodman?
Could George the Animal Steel or Lou Albano?
Go ahead, Thomas.
I just think that there's no redeeming quality into putting George Steel in the Hall of Fame. He had the same match from 1973 until 1988. So the old age factor couldn't factor in. It was hide that foreign object, do that song and dance for 12 minutes. He screws up, gets rolled up, match over. So the feuds, you know, maybe they were good in 81 with Backlund. Maybe they were good in the mid-70s with Bruno. I don't think they were very good compared to everything else.
They weren't.
I think that when you look at the feuds that Backlund had, forget about it. When you look at Bruno, Spiro's, Arion, hell, even Nikolai Volkoff had better feuds with Bruno than George Animal Steel did. So obviously the only thing you're looking at there is moving the box office. And like I said, who sold more tickets and more pay-per-views? When you factor in dollar for dollar, guys that were one-hit wonders like Dennis Rodman and Lawrence Taylor did more for the company they worked for, WCW, WWF, than George Steele did in 25 years.
Who did more for the WWF, George Steele or Spiros Arion?
Arion.
Spiros Arion, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, two quick things about Steele. The thing that I would come up with if I was like really lobbying for him, he might be the non-WWF champion with the most main events at Madison Square Garden. I didn't count them. I'm saying maybe. But that's not trivia. That's trivial. And number two, just as an aside, in 1983, when they announced, you know, Vince gets on TV, it's like, and returning to the WWF, batting down the hatches, I literally had a tantrum. Because this means one of my 10 Boston Garden shows per year has been ruined. Just like that. And it was.
He was a security blanket if they couldn't think of anything else. He knew he was going to be a certain amount of a draw, not much, but it was going to be a complete disaster usually until the end. He was a security blanket. You know, he was all reliable. You knew he'd be there.
And here's the thing, and this isn't even about Steele. I don't think it hurts to have anyone on a ballot, okay? It doesn't. But I just cannot even picture George Steele getting Hall of Fame consideration. I am sorry. So there we go. Thomas, who's next on your list?
The next one I have on my list, another non-wrestler per se. Everyone will agree, you know, some people may throw Jim Cornette's name in there and I won't dispute him, but Bobby Heenan is the greatest manager of all time. And That's a foregone conclusion. But I will argue that Jimmy Hart's run in Memphis was the greatest managerial run in wrestling history.
Okay, Sean's about to ask you to marry him, but go ahead.
When you look from 80 until early 85, it takes two to tango. And Lawler and Hart were the ones that kept Memphis thriving that entire time. And it was when you get to Joe LeDuc, Dream Machine, the Iranian Assassin, Coco Ware, in and of themselves, Pork Chop Cash, in and of themselves,
Wayne Ferris,
in and of themselves, they're probably not going to sell out the Mid-South Coliseum for half a decade. But it was Jimmy Hart. Jimmy Hart was the backbone of Memphis wrestling from 80 to 85.
Without question.
And if you're going to give the credit to Lawler and to Jerry Jarrett and to Lance and to Dave, it's almost negligible to ignore Jimmy Hart just because of a WWF run, which I will say up until about late 88 was fine in of itself anyway. When he had Adonis, when he had the Hart Foundation, when he had Bundy early on, he was just fine. And then the cartoonish aspect, they kept lampooning Jimmy Hart more and more of it as a parody of himself, to whereby, you know, mid to late 89, 88, when he had the Rouges and Honky Tonk Man Only, he looked like a complete clown. And then that's the other thing, where kind of like JYD, from 88 all the way through 96, he was a total goof. But that 80, and I'll go ahead and say 80 to 88 run, because I think he was fine those first 3 years with McMahon, more than warrants a trip to the Hall of Fame for him.
He was fine for the first 3 years, McMahon, but I wouldn't confuse it with the first. I mean, I'm just saying I would, because there's your argument, those first 5 years. And yeah, I'm pretty much sold now. I wanted to complain about the later years, but those first five were so great. They were throwing he kept them alive that first year. Okay, when Lawler went down and that whole thing happened, he single-handedly kept them alive. And then after that, he was everyone they threw in there. Kevin Sullivan, Paul Ellering. It didn't matter. Everything worked because it was always Lawler Hart, and everyone else was just a proxy.
Well, two quick things. I think I've mentioned this on the show before. When that old Georgia Championship Wrestling show was on in 1984, me at 19 years old would get up at like 6, 7 in the morning just to see that show because Jimmy Hart was on it. He was phenomenal. I had never seen him before, but I couldn't believe what I was seeing. He was a tornado. He was the greatest thing ever, the greatest manager I had ever seen until that point. Number two, I had been told a long time ago by someone in the business that Bobby Heenan did everything he could to undermine Jimmy Hart. Like he would, Heenan's opinion in the WWF was valued, and he was the guy who said, hey, you should have Jimmy Hart do this stupid thing and talk like this and do that stupid thing.
Yeah, I heard that too from you, but yeah, I heard.
Oh, okay. All right. So who's next?
He is. Well, one other thing about. Quick question. I wish I had this. I had both for this one. But how much of an influence do you think in Jimmy's rapid development? Because he never spoke until Jerry got injured. How much of that could be credited to Lance?
A lot.
Well,
no question.
I think Lance, if Lance sandbags him, then Jimmy could have easily been a one-hit wonder. But to touch on your point, though, John, about Heenan undermining Jimmy, think about Jimmy's WWF run. Did he ever cut a serious promo like he ever did in Memphis? He's all high-pitched, squealy, and screaming and talking a mile a minute in every promo with McMahon. And I wonder if that, where there's smoke, there's fire sort of thing, where he just turned into a total lampooned, caricature of himself to where you couldn't even take him seriously anymore. Like, that guy can't mean he's the world champion. Look at him.
Oh, yeah. For those who did not see Jimmy, and you nailed the point. The thing that he was missing in WWF, they did not have, that he had in Memphis, was that just little bit of nastiness behind all the humor. It was just a little bit of sadism. And the interview I always use for this, as an example, is the one with Ricky Gibson back in, I want to say it was 80 or 81, where I don't remember the whole story, but one of his parents was deaf, I believe.
His mom.
And Jimmy was mocking that he was going to break his fingers so he couldn't use sign language.
Yeah, and you know what, though? I get it. 1985 WWF is not doing that. That's not who they are.
Oh, I understand that. That's way hardcore. But, I mean, you could start inserting a little bit of that. It's the same argument I had with Terry Taylor that they didn't do in JCP, which was give him that little bit of an edge that he had in Mid-South. And it killed the character. Same thing with Hart in New York.
One thing about Hart in New York, and I you can't help but notice this, as soon as they decide to give King Kong Bundy a huge push, they transfer him over from Hart to Heenan. And again, my understanding was that was not an accident.
That would have worked well. He would have worked well with Bundy. Because especially if you get that little edge. No, but I mean, if you had like the big main event and you just gave him that little bit of an edge that he had in Memphis, that I think that would have been, that may have been, at that time, might have been even better than Heenan.
Well, when you look at what Hart inherited, he inherited a post-prime Morocco, a post-prime Valentine, Adonis, when they just kind of threw their hands up in the air with him. And they gave him the Hart Foundation, and they gave him Wayne Ferris as just, you know, here, take something. Give these guys a mouthpiece. They never gave him the world title threat. Valentine had already done his run with Hogan, as had Morocco, once Jimmy Hart got a hold of him. Ace Orton was already, you know, cashing his checks, not worrying about what was happening by the time he came with Jimmy Hart. He was basically slick before he was slick.
Yeah. He turned Wayne Ferris into a main eventer twice in two different areas.
I think he helped as part of the package with Ferris, but my understanding has always been that McMahon was in love with that character and he was getting it over. And it's to Vince's credit. Once he decides that he wants something over, he's getting it over. He's going to die trying.
Yeah, that's all. He has nearly died trying a couple times. Okay, I mean, you could say what you want, but that guy was over at one point, and that's why the whole Ultimate Warrior thing took off. They hated the guy.
Yeah,
and
when you think about it,
Jimmy.
No, go ahead, Thomas.
Think of the guys that Jimmy really got over as a heel manager that really had no business. He got Beefcake over with Honky Tonk Man. He got Warrior over with Honky Tonk Man. Now Warrior would have gotten over himself, but that was part of the reason. Forget about Johnny V and the Valentine split up. Beefcake Honky Tonk Man is where Beefcake got his bones. Jake Roberts, you know, was already over, but got over as a face. Macho Man shot to the stratosphere, you know, facing a Jimmy Hart guy. Heenan talked a good game, but when you cut down to it, after the Hogan Andre run, there was not a lot of world title opportunities for Rude and Perfect. By late 88, they were kind of phasing away what managers were going to be. You can almost kind of see it in the works that McMahon was going to start phasing out Hart and Heenan eventually to where, you know, where they were by, you know, 91.
Jimmy in 86 was kind of like Bobby in 74. Jimmy still had that more, that almost fearlessness about him. I mean, he's lucky he didn't get killed in Memphis. I mean, it was just a fearlessness that you know, Bobby at that point by the 80s, you know, it'd been a while. I forgot when after the Steeler dynasty ended, with the doctor told the owner, he goes, they just don't want to hit the ground anymore. I mean, you know, you can only take so many bumps.
And Heenan took hellacious bumps.
Yeah.
And, you know, and from what I understand, he just didn't want to be a manager anymore, which is why he got into broadcasting and he made an exception for Ric Flair. At least temporarily, he made an exception for Ric Flair. But, yeah, interesting. So, Sean, who is next? Who would you like to discuss?
George Scott.
Okay.
Basically invented Mid-Atlantic as you would know it, JCP as you would know it. He's the one who kind of set that up, because that was a straight-up tag team area, very regional. He's the one that gave it kind of a big feel, a more of a national feel to it, when he brought in Valentine, when he brought in McDaniel, you know, and then, he started bringing in, you know, he started developing Flair, developed Valentine, developed Ricky Steamboat, brought in Paul Jones. And, you know, had the Andersons in for years. And then, you know, and then after that, he goes, you know, he had a couple stops between there, but then he goes to WWF, and he is the booker of record for, you know, 84. Is he booker of record for WrestleMania 1?
I believe so.
I mean, you know, that's enough of a contribution for me.
You know, I never seriously thought about George Scott before, but you just made a heck of a case for him.
I mean, he reminds me of, in football, there's a guy, there's a coach named Clark Shaughnessy. I see him every year on the ballot. It drives me nuts. He invented, you know, an offense that was used for 60 years and the modern zone defense, and he's still on the ballot. That's what I think of when I see George Scott. I'm like, this guy, just look at the people he developed.
Yeah.
I mean, Rick Flair will give the credit for him for the whole thing, for the, you know, the act.
I'm more of a big Hall guy myself, and I'm not disputing the fact that I don't, like I said on the email before we prepped for the show, I had a list of 10 names, but I could have easily put 18 or 20 on there, where Scott didn't make my cut. I certainly see him as a Hall of Famer. I guess his mismanagement, according to Cornette anyway, of late 80s NWA, if you remember the story about the Clash of the Champions in New Orleans, if you're familiar with that story, and how he muddled that up. That's kind of a funny story right there. And that kind of takes a little shine off me. But yeah, he's a Hall of Famer.
Speaking of that, there was speculation, and I want to underline that word, speculation, that when George Scott was with the NWA in 88, early 89, that he was actually getting two paychecks. One from Vince and one from WCW. Speculation. I can't underline that enough.
How much do you thank George Scott for Piper getting that push? Because you know the McMahons didn't like him as a main eventer. He was in there before, and they took him out.
Yeah, but by that point, you're right. They brought him in 79, and they supposedly Vince Sr. took one look at him and sent him home.
He was a little bigger, but not much.
By that point in 84, Piper went out and proved that he was a huge star in Georgia. He was a huge star in the Carolinas. Before that, he had been a huge star in Portland.
No, he wasn't. Wasn't he in Mid-Atlantic by then?
He came to Mid-Atlantic towards the end of 1980.
Okay.
Drove cross-country from Portland. According
but still,
to
that's still the main event. And you could tell he was hesitant because they kept using him as a manager.
Yeah,
I think Piper gets
right.
That push, no matter if George Scott's there or not.
I think that as well. I mean, Piper was, you know, he was such a huge star on TBS, you know, for a while in the Carolinas. I have the feeling that him being a manager at first kind of really showed that they had special plans for him, that he wasn't just going to be another wrestler.
It was unusual for Vince to go for the smaller guy, no matter how over the guy is. It usually kills him to do that. That's why you almost expect him to go for the Brody. Or even Paul Orndorff made more sense, because it's kind of in the ballpark.
I look at the reason why they made Piper a manager early on was they just gotten Orndorff, they had just gotten Schultz, and they didn't want Piper spinning his tires, having a feud with David Sammartino or Tito Santana and having a give-take feud undermining his credibility. I think they figured once Hogan finished with Pipe or with Orndorff, finished with Schultz, there was the final boss, there was Roddy Piper at the end.
And think about this, Piper and Snuka was a main event in major arenas while Hulk Hogan was main eventing somewhere else.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, Piper and Tonga Kid.
And before that, Piper and Rocky Johnson. Thomas, what's your beef with Rocky Johnson?
I just think if his kid was an auto mechanic, his name wouldn't be on the ballot right now.
Huh.
If his kid was named Jeff Johnson, your local state senator, you would not even think about Rocky Johnson being on this ballot.
Well, let's look at what you have. He was a main eventer in Florida. He was a main eventer in Memphis, main eventer in the WWF.
He really wasn't a main eventer in the WWF, though.
Well, in the early 80s, every once in a while. Not a consistent one, but he was there occasionally.
He was a top guy, if you put it that way.
Okay, fair enough.
He was definitely behind Backlund and Snuka. Main event in Houston, in Dallas, in Portland. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer. But I think I don't think there's anything unusual about him being on the ballot.
I think he's around Morocco.
I wouldn't.
Maybe a little below Morocco.
Think about guys that have no chance of getting in the Hall of Fame. Would you say clear cut that Rocky Johnson is more qualified to be in the Hall of Fame than, say, a Tony Atlas, a Dick Slater, a Dick Murdoch, a Mike Graham. I personally put all those guys head and shoulders above Rocky Johnson.
No, I wouldn't. Not Mike Graham and not Tony Atlas.
I wouldn't put Tony Atlas ahead of him either. But, yeah, hey,
he could have been.
Different opinions. But, yeah, Rocky, you know, Rocky was one of those guys who in the mid to late 70s, I bought him as a legit contender for the NWA title, as in I wouldn't have been totally shocked if I walked into the drugstore, opened up the magazine, and saw that he had won the belt.
Would you be more surprised about Rocky Johnson or Tommy Rich?
I would say I would be more surprised by Rocky Johnson, but not by much. Tommy Rich was a star.
A very big star on the national network, yes.
Yeah. So, speaking of guys that I do not understand why they're on the ballot, I just see no candidacy for them. Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson with J.J. Dillon. Hey, I'm a big fan. But these guys started teaming regularly towards the end of the summer of 1987. And by Thanksgiving, the Survivor Series 1989, they bounced Tully and they never teamed again. So these guys were together for like 2 years.
John, cut that time in half because the ballot says Tully and Arn with J.J. Dillon. So by fall of 88, that crumbles away.
You are 100% correct.
Now, the argument I can make for the time thing is the fact that I would put the Graham brothers in there, well, the Graham Quote brothers in there, and they were only together for a year and a half. But they were a main event virtually the entire time they were there, as opposed to those two, who, as good as they were, and they were great, how many main events did they have in that time?
None in any major arenas.
Okay, they weren't even the best person on the card.
So, right. I mean, so like I said, I look at this. Most of the guys on the ballot, I can at least see someone making a case for, even if they fall short. Like, Tully and Arn with JJ, I cannot even see, like, getting out of the garage to make a case for these guys.
Let me ask you a no-brainer question, but just to humor myself. Is 16 months of Tully and Arn in the NWA, does that hold more stock than a decade of Gagne and Brunzell in the AWA?
Hell no. It's a no-brainer. It's not even a question.
Yeah. No question about it. I'll take the high flyers.
I have been told by people who know what they're talking about that these guys, old-time AWA fans, that there are some out there that claim that they were better than the Rock and Roll Express.
They're like Backlund. If you put them in with the, from what I've seen, they're like Backlund. If you put them in with the right people, they're going to be really, really good.
Brunzell and Gagne?
The High Flyers.
Right. I mean, my understanding was you could put them in there with anybody and they'd be really good.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking Greg toward the end, I guess, but most of the tag teams they're running up against, I mean, they had the East-West Express, which was a very good feud. Adonis and
Ventura, remember him?
Ventura, yeah. Yeah. That was a great feud.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they were always really good. But, I mean, if you had them in there with the right team, they could have some great, great matches.
Well, go ahead, Thomas.
Well, let's look at even more time frame here. Are Tully and Arn necessarily that much better than the Fabulous Ones?
No, they're not.
No.
And you'll never see them on the ballot. You'll never see the Fantastics on the ballot. I mean, you get on down the line with that. You'll never see them ahead of, you know, obviously they sold a hell of a lot more tickets than the Rougeau brothers. But you watch that Rougeau brother British Bulldog match from SummerSlam 88. That is one of the most, in my opinion, most underrated openers in pay-per-view history. For two teams that were just spinning tires in the WWF, they were going nowhere, they put on a hell of a match.
Now, the reason the old WWF pay-per-views almost always opened with a hot match is, I guess there was some kind of rule back then where if the if you order a pay-per-view and you decide within, I forget what it was, 10 or 15 minutes, that
5 minutes,
I don't want it anymore. No, not now. Back then, you had to call and talk to somebody. You could call your cable company and tell them, hey, I decided I don't want this. So the WWF made it a practice to have something really good on the first match every time.
It was one other thing, too, is that back then what they used to do is that the first 5 minutes of a pay-per-view would be free to try to goad you into buying it.
Yeah.
Exactly. As someone, I think the statute of limitations has run out, but with someone who grew up with a black box as a kid, you would get the first 5 minutes of the show, and then it would scramble, and then Dad would walk over with the knob and kind of fudge it till it came back in again. But yeah, you got the first 5 minutes for free up until, I want to say like 91, 92, I think that was the case.
Huh. That's interesting. I a long story about me with my black box, but it wasn't even for wrestling. This has been an amazing show. Thomas, thank you for going out of your way to participate with us.
More than my pleasure, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Sean, thank you as always for your contribution. You were great as usual. Want to throw in before I forget, if you enjoy the show, you'll enjoy our Facebook page. It is the Stick to Wrestling Facebook page. Very easy to find. Thank you all for listening, and this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We'll see you next week.